Welcome to This Week in FX PhD, your weekly wrap-up and behind the scenes at fxphd.com.
Hi, and welcome to This Week at FX PhD. John Montgomery with you, joined as always by Mike. How's it going, my friend?
A little tired. Had a sort of point of singularity last night at the premiere and party for Interstellar. So if I'm a little slow this morning, it's because time is traveling differently for me right now.
I saw that you tweeted regarding that. You said that, I believe, and I'm paraphrasing, it would have looked really good in digital.
Yeah, isn't that an unpopular thing for me to say? you know how Nolan's been going on, you know, and I've fair enough too, he's Christopher Nolan, about wanting to shoot on film and everything up above film. And so I went and saw this on one of only 50 screens in the world that's showing the 15x70mm film version of Interstellar. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's basically 70mm film of a film that was primarily shot on film. I got to say, it looked like film to me. And that's a good thing, I guess, but also it's not quite as sharp, it's not quite as bright, it's not quite as, it's kind of grainy. Blacks aren't, you know, I'm just so used to the perfection of digital. I remember, God, it must have been with you, I think, when we were in the States once, we first saw Toy Story projected digitally. And yes, we walked down to the screen because it was so rock steady on the screen. It just seemed like it was a poster that was stuck on the screen as opposed to a projected image. Which, you know, isn't the case with film. So, I'm sorry, but, you know, I know it's an unpopular thing to say, but everybody says, even the people that I was talking to at IMAX, they were like, yeah, it's kind of sad. It's probably the last, you know, big kind of IMAX-y films that are filmed, blah, blah, blah. You know, we're one of the few places that can project it. And I'm like, yeah, I actually think digital's good.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of yearning for nostalgia. And I mean, there are some reasons. I mean, he likes it, obviously. But yeah, I think there's a big difference when we're becoming more and more accustomed to what are effectively a lack of artifacts in digital acquisition. Of course, obviously, there are other issues with it. But as the dynamic range gets greater and stuff, those trade-offs become, I personally feel as well, more and more in favor of digital.
Yeah, it really does have a lot of things going for it, but also you've kind of forgotten how digital's kept improving. I mean, like in the early days when digital came along, it was the case that, you know, it just didn't quite feel as sort of warm and as interesting as film, but digital has improved and improved and improved. And then, you know, like I've seen some really big films like Gravity projected and, you know, other films that we saw at the same cinema, you know, projected digitally, and a really, really good digital projector, I think, is just like it's a better quality image. And here's the thing, the film in the IMAX anyway loses nothing in the big wide shots. It's in the close-ups that you can really tell. Like you've got shots of actors' faces and stuff, and that's where you start to kind of get the artifacts of film not holding the, because, you know, like we're now used to kind of seeing the pores and the skin and the real, you know, and this is a very, people are shot in an unflattering way at times. And I understand the film aesthetic. And I'm not saying that it's bad. It's just, I think it would have worked really well as well if it had been shot digitally.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned projection as well. That's another place where there's certainly been tremendous advancements as well as that in the brightness and clarity and resolution and so forth. So,
but thank the Lord it wasn't shot in stereo.
Stereo on film? Yeah.
Yeah.
In IMAX? Yes, that wouldn't have been. So how's it going? We're in week number four of the term. Enjoying it so far. There have been some nice threads on the site. A big interest, I think, in the Nuke Studio course. I've gotten at least in support a lot of emails about that because last week the Foundry had their Nuke 9 event live. You can actually still check out that event in case you missed it live to see what's new in Nuke 9. And so forth. But yeah, it seems to be off to a good start, and certainly a lot of interest in studio simply because of that announcement last week.
Yeah, yeah. And we're very happy to be you know, working so closely with the Foundry to be able to bring you guys this stuff, because it's great when something new is happening. You can really get on top of it early, especially if you're in a facility. You know, you want to kind of stand out from the crowd and not just be following the pack. And if you can be the person that's up to speed and able to help others and do stuff, it's a great feeling.
Yeah, and especially it's, what's nice about it is we have, you know, the early access to the beta outside the release of the other other products. We have that available on beta, and it is still beta software. But in addition to that, obviously the other software that bears a similarity, at least at heart, in that is, of course, Flame. Obviously, in the way that it serves as a hub for both assembly and finishing. I'm talking about Nuke Studio. But we also have some really cool access as well, before anyone else, to the new learning editions of not just Flare and not just Flame Assist on OS X, but also actually access to the learning edition of Flame itself on Linux. While we don't have a course in that, obviously, if you're interested in that, you can get your hands on and check out what Flame is like. If you want, just go ahead and fill out a support form, click the help link and say that you'd like to be involved in the beta. Autodesk has a special beta area set up where they run everyone through with the personal accounts, not FXPhD accounts, but personal accounts on this where you sign an NDA. And then you'll have access to download software. I think it's, they don't have a release date or anything about it yet, but it seems as though they're in the final stages of testing it. Say that because last week the new Flame 2015 Extension 2, which is kind of the midterm release of Flame, actually came out. So I kind of expect this to be not so far along, but I'm sure, number one, get your hands on it early. If you haven't checked out Flame, it's a great way of doing that. But also, actually, frankly, help Autodesk and some of the testing to make sure there aren't any serious bugs before they release this software into the wild. Because, Mike, I think a lot of, you know, it's going to be quite a few quite a few new users, people who aren't used to using Flame or haven't used Flame in the past. And I think as we saw with the Smoke release, it opens up kind of a whole new realm in the type of person who's accessing it. So it's really helpful. You know, it's great that Autodesk is giving our members access to this, but frankly, I also think it's helpful for Autodesk to have our members testing it out as well, because they get that kind of feedback from the, what I'd say, non-traditional, non-facility type user.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is absolutely the case. And I don't think that the Smoke release was the best release in terms of timing bugs. And
you're being quite kind.
Yeah. When they came out, I think it was premature. And I think that it could have had more impact had they delayed it. It's just really hard. There's so much pressure to release. Everyone says, I don't care. It's good. And then, you know, you go, actually, it doesn't work so well. Why'd you release it? Well, because you were begging me to. Yeah, sorry.
And I think actually, to that point, I think the initial release of Smoke on Mac was a little hamstrung over time because of that bugginess. You know, I know quite a few people. I think Jason Wingrove, who's, of course, you guys know from the RC, was one of those people. You try it out, and if it doesn't install or you have issues with it, you know, just even simply getting it up and running, boy, that's going to turn you off right out of the gate. So it's really important that this time this stuff works and is bulletproof and only has those normal bugs that all of us are used to dealing with when we use software. I mean, that's, you know, that's a given when you're running software, but it's that other, it's those other more serious bugs that can, I think, you know, set a perception right out of the gate. And it's really, really hard to regain or tilt a perspective, or perception of a piece of software after the fact. I mean, man, Final Cut to this day, is still suffering.
Sorry, what was that?
Final Cut. To this day.
What's that?
I'm slow today.
Little.
But yeah, exactly.
Do you remember we went to the Final Cut presentation of the in NAB? It was the, you know, we were still on the version of Final Cut that we used, and they were showing the version that would make us all stop using it. But they showed it at a user group thing in Vegas, and I remember the place was packed. There was such an air of anticipation. Mm-hmm. This was going to be amazing. Today, ghost town. Yeah. Tumbleweeds blowing through.
And by all accounts, and again, we don't, you know, we don't use it. We've stopped using it since that point. We're fully on Premiere for getting materials out internally at FXPhD. But from people I talked to, I mean, we had Scott Simmons doing a course with us last term. I've talked to him quite a bit about it. In fairness, they have made some very nice improvements in Final Cut. It's still lacking in some areas, but it's a dramatically different product from that initial release. But because of that initial release, it's really difficult to get people back.
Mm.
So Anywho, just so anyway, get to the point about the flame stuff. Do that as soon as possible. If you're listening to the podcast, drop us a line at support, because the software is probably going to come out soon, but we'd love to get you guys into it before everybody else. So if you're up for that, fill out a support request.
Actually, I don't want to like backtrack, but just one thing on that the general discussion. One thing on that sort of rat hole of distraction. Even though I'm down on Final Cut, I should say I'm equally up on Adobe. And mm-hmm. I think that what Adobe has done is magnificent. They don't seem to be putting major steps wrong. They seem to be contributing to R&D. Yeah, they've come up with a pricing model that is basically getting more money out of the industry, but that's what they're in business to do. But, you know, you have to say it's like every time I go and use Word and Excel and sort of it feels bloatweary, I go to use Premiere and it just doesn't. It just doesn't feel like Lightroom and Premiere and those products sort of suffered the same fate. You know, because even today, no matter how long it's been out and it's, you know, like Word just drives me nuts. And I don't do that with Premiere and Photoshop and Lightroom. I enjoy using them. I think Adobe's managed to increase the functionality, maintain a kind of presence. And also, I think they've provided a very reliable view of a company for somebody that's thinking about whether or not, like away from us, right? Away from like hardcore pro users. They provide a company that looks like it's stable and going to be around and do sensible things and not chop and change. And I really think Adobe deserves a lot of, you know, as much as we ran from Final Cut, we certainly ran to Premiere.
Yeah, we certainly did. And having attended Adobe Max several weeks ago now, and I may have touched on it in the DOD, but the perception from attending that is that Adobe is going out all stops, top-notch company, top-notch event. That's Adobe Max. I mean, people are paying for that, so it needs to be. But there was an air of professionalism and polish in it without being too polished, you know, without being too formal. You know, we're talking a stage, you know, on the sneaks, they had this giant rotating screen on stage with multi-screen presentations in between during the intro. Amazing before the keynote events, really cool, well-designed multi-screen graphics and so forth and video clips. Again, the image that they're presenting throughout the company from top to bottom, and not just delivering great software, but just that perception, it's really impressive. That whole Creative Cloud thing for them must be doing really well, because if the whole Creative Cloud subscription thing wasn't doing well, they probably wouldn't be in a position to do that. I think they're a very smart company and do really, you know, maybe the initial rollout was a bit tough, but unlike the other ones we're talking about, you know, it was minor hurdles, you know, more complaining, I think, about price, more complaining about people's idea of losing, perpetual access to software. I think those were more of the concerns than actual botched implementation with, you know, a few minor, there were a few minor examples of, you know, things where you'd lose cloud connectivity and couldn't open up your app, but far and away, it was a great rollout. They're also really doing interesting stuff with their mobile access, mobile apps as well. Not just, again, not for our market, but actually taking some of those Adobe technologies and putting them on tablets and phones and things like that.
Yeah, hey, sorry, my morning green tea went down the wrong way then, and I nearly choked. But
did we talk
about what you were saying?
No, did we talk at all? And I can't remember. And did we talk about a little bit about the API that Adobe did at Adobe Max?
I don't think so, and I'd love to.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. So basically, it's not being used anything, but their mobile. I think their mobile business model, if you haven't guessed already, with a bunch of free apps, is to do two things: serve customers who purchase Creative Cloud subscription and use those free apps, frankly, to develop a marketing, a base of people to market to. Okay. So when you're giving away something for free, all the free apps, even if you're doing, you know, the Premiere free app on the iPad, you still have to create an Adobe.com account. All right. So that's smart. But what's quite interesting, and I think one of the, really interesting things that they announced this year was this idea of an API, and what the API allows you to do as an app developer is actually within your app access some of the Adobe tools. So let's say that you wanted to, access or send something to Lightroom. That's a really simple idea. You'll use some type of Lightroom effect that's in the API. As an app developer, if you had a camera app, you could download the Adobe API and give your customers free access to the processing tools that are part of the Adobe API. It's really a smart move. And again, they're giving that away for free. The whole idea behind the API is, at least at this point, it's free. And it's just opening that up to more and more people across applications, not just Adobe applications. It's pretty cool. I mean, I think in the long term, actually, what could be interesting if you think about it, and I'm not sure they can give it away for free, but look at some of the technology that they have in After Effects. Let's take the Warp Stabilizer, all right? This doesn't work all the time, but when it does, it's fantastic. How nice would it be for people to be able to kind of shoot a quick video on their phone and then run it through within, you know, some kind of video app, just say, okay, process this in the Warp Stabilizer, have that go off in the cloud, get it re-downloaded, and you've got a nice stabilized video for free. Those are the type of things that kind of opens up. And I think it's a really smart move to make those tools more accessible. It hooks people on Adobe because, again, you have to create an Adobe account to use that. And you, frankly, get access to some really interesting tools.
Yeah. Lightroom on the mobile, though. Can I just go to there for a second?
Yeah.
Okay, so having praised Adobe to death, do you using Lightroom on the
all the time? It's kind of my go-to app.
Can you like maybe do a whole background class on how to work that bugger? Because I have no freaking idea. Like I've looked it up a couple of times and then I've just deleted it. It's like literally, and like Jeff said to me this the other day. He said, "Oh yeah, it's really good. I'm going to learn how to use it and stuff." And I'm like, "Okay," feeling like a numbskull. And he was like, "Yeah, it was a little hard to get into initially." And I was like, "Oh, thank the Lord for that," because man.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I've just, it's the only Adobe product that I've looked at and gone, nah.
I really like it. I actually, an example, and I haven't posted it yet, so you haven't seen it, but I actually went on a 8-mile hike over the weekend in the desert outside Grand Junction, and I'd left my new Sony beautiful camera at home. And so I said, well, you know what? It's actually be interesting to take out the iPhone and see how it does. And what was really nice about it is, you know, I took all the images on the iPhone, opened up Lightroom. It automatically syncs into Lightroom, made some adjustments. But then I go to my desktop and I can make further refinements right on the photos, on those photos right on the desktop. It's a really nice integration. And from my standpoint, not being, you would know, I don't know if they ever had that functionality as much in Aperture and iPhoto, or did Apple have that, Mike, when you were using Aperture? I just don't remember that kind of nice, slick integration. What's also interesting, and this is also something about the API and what Adobe's doing in the cloud, is that storage that's part of Lightroom Mobile is actually not counted against your storage anywhere. It's effectively unlimited free storage that you have.
Oh, really?
And I say free because, well, it's not free because you're going to sync with it with the Creative Cloud account. So you are paying something, right? There's a cost to that.
Yeah.
But that storage in that synced library from Lightroom Mobile does not count against your Creative Cloud storage application. That same thing actually holds true as well for the Adobe Premiere app that's on the tablet. So if you have a bunch of movies and you're working with a bunch of movies on your iPad, that actually works by syncing everything to cloud. That doesn't count against your storage as well. That comes along for free at this point in time. If, however, you take it and move it to Adobe Premiere Desktop, then it does become part of your cloud storage. But up to that point, all those videos are stored up in the cloud. You're not paying an additional cost on top of what you're already paying, which with the Premiere Pro app on iPad or whatever, you're not paying much at all, or you're not paying anything. So anyway. Yeah, I was actually a big fan, and you're right. It does take a little bit of getting used to with Lightroom and getting photos back and forth. But once you get the hang of it, it's really nice to have a great majority of those tools available and accessible in Lightroom on mobile. It's not all the tools, it's not all the adjustments, but it's actually a really nice start because I've used a ton of various photo apps that do grading stuff over the years on the iPhone. And this is the one now that I use almost exclusively now.
Okay, cool. That's good to know.
I'll do a private background for you.
Oh my God.
You and the members, yeah. If you want.
Yeah. No, I would really love that. I'm actually been testing and doing stuff with the iPhone's camera, and I just am stunned. I didn't intend to do this. It's just that every time we've done some stuff lately, I've been pulling out the iPhone and shooting some test shots. Mm-hmm. And in this week's DO, or actually it's last week's, I think it's a bit laid out, DOP class, we did the same thing on a boat because I don't want to do some slow motion shots of on the boat. And I've got to say, John, both, you know, Ben and myself, and Ben's like obviously professional DOP, kind of stunned at how uncrap the iPhone 6 camera is. Now, you might say that this is how it is, dear listeners, on Samsung or some other device I don't use. All I'm saying is, as far as I'm concerned, not having any other device, but moving from a 5 to a 6, I'm stunned at how much better the camera is. And it's not even the big iPhone.
You don't have the optical stabilization,
no,
right?
No. But I mean, I'm looking at it in terms of noise, dynamic range, clipping. There are a bunch of things it don't have. But it started occurring to me that, see, the reason I was just shooting some stuff, right, obviously. For fun. But then the reason I started thinking about it in terms of PhD is I thought, well, if these pictures look that good, it's a bit like, aren't clients going to suddenly start saying, hey, I've got this shot that we wanted to integrate in. And then you're suddenly going, oh, you know, like literally they shoot something slow-mo and they want to add it to some, you know, TVC or something that they're doing or use it for getting, I don't know. You know, like imagine you were shooting a commercial where you were on the streets of somewhere or other and you didn't want to look like you were shooting or something. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of going commando and rebel. Well, could you use the iPhone footage? I mean, that's a question. In fact, I might even do a background on this because it's just surprising. There's a whole lot of little things that came up when Ben and I were talking about this, but we announced at the end of that class our idea how to make a ton of money if you're an iPhone developer person, because we have one idea which as soon as it's out there, I'm sure it'll get on Kickstarter. We'll buy it. We'll back it. But yeah, it's one thing that we'd love to see for that. But apart from that, it's a serious question. Like, would somebody start actually appearing with footage? You know, like when GoPros first appeared, it wasn't long before people just found really good reasons to incorporate them in a ton of stuff. I don't even know that it has to cut in to look seamless. But this stuff on Sydney Harbour, when we were looking at it, it was not immediately obvious what was Canon 5D Mark III versus what was the iPhone, other than we had to put a LUT on the Canon stuff because we shoot cine style, of course,
okay,
to get a little logarithmic curve. But if you didn't have that, if you just had like three clips in a row, just looking at them in DaVinci, until you touch them, and obviously they don't stand up, especially the slow-mo stuff, but until you touch them and start doing a lot of grading with them, just straight out of the gate, you're like, which one of these was the iPhone? That one? Oh, okay. but there are a few things that, I mean, it's obviously not it's a phone that has a camera, not a camera that also makes phone calls.
Right.
But yeah, I'm betting that people are going to start, wandering into, with commercials and saying, look, we shot this thing where we were seeing if somebody liked this product and on the street and the thing and it was shot on an iPhone and it's going to be like, really? Okay. What's the EDL timeline sort of workflow pipeline for processing iPhone footage? What's the tracking like? I don't know. It's just some fun stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. And the other thing, and it's getting a little bit outside PhD, but it's interesting what they've done as well. And maybe this is old news to you, but it wasn't to me. But the way that Apple now is treating video and photos within their own apps is similar to actually what happens in Lightroom in many ways. And by that, I mean, you're not actually editing the original file or changing the original file. The things that you're doing to it are actually, the information is contained actually as metadata. So you know how you can go in now and actually edit the image settings and color and exposure and so forth in photos on your iPhone. You're not actually touching the original photo. If you sync your photos to your computer, you're going to get the original JPEG file, as well as actually sidecar file, which actually contains those adjustments. So there's a little file alongside, in it for the instance of the video file where you're shooting slow-mo. You actually end up having an entire clip, that in my case, when I did the test, is actually running at about 220 frames per second. So you download a QuickTime movie, you've got a 229 frame per second QuickTime movie. So it effectively runs in real time, obviously very quickly. But the information about where you have the slow-mo chunks and things like that as part of your video is actually sidecar file, which is kind of interesting. I think it'd be interesting to be able to hook into some of that, and, you know, be able to use it and, you know, pick up the color correction or something like that that you had already, similar to what you can do in Lightroom, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's some of the stuff we're going to look at, because that's the stuff we've been playing with here on our workflows, just working out what's the best way to do stuff. And some apps, you know, read information really well and present it in the way you kind of want, and other apps don't.
Yeah, in this case, all the informational data and adjustments you make, is at least the movie file with that stuff, is all in kind of hex-coded data, binary data format. So you don't really have a great way of looking to see what you actually did. But it's kind of a, I don't know, you can just kind of just see where they're going with it. Anyway, a little bit of a digression, but I found it kind of interesting. I think it's actually a smart way of doing things, though confusing at first if you think all your adjustments are going to be intact when you download the photo onto your local desktop.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny that, isn't it? Like, I was talking to somebody, just how much some people use their iPhone for photos, and the destination of their photos is their same iPhone. And I mean, this is true for Android as well, but you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I was of the school, you took a photo, and then the photo's end game was not the camera that it was taken on. You know, like, just that's inherently a base assumption as to the way photography worked. But I noticed with my kids, they take a bunch of photos and they don't want to put them anywhere else. They just want to have them on their phone. And sometimes they'll look at them when they're bored, and sometimes they'll send them to friends. But a lot of photos are just kept on their phone, and they'll use them on their phone or look at them on their phone. They'll show other people on their phone, but they'll never take them off the phone in a sense that we would naturally assume the first thing you do is clear the card.
Yeah, exactly. That's not very different.
Yeah, it's a completely mental kind of way of thinking about it, you know. And I'm like, well, what happens when your phone fills up? And they go, well, we'll delete some photos, but you keep on buying new phones that are bigger, and then you hand us down your old ones, and so we just get more space that way. And I'm like, do you understand how impractical that is? And they're like, yeah, yeah, but you got 128 gig phone. So by the time I fill up this iPhone 5, you'll give me your 128 gig iPhone 6 and I'll be fine. And I'm like, okay. So we can't keep the videos all the time, but, you know, we stick them on. I mean, they're obviously sticking stuff on various Snapchat-y type things.
Right.
But not all the photos. They don't delete them all. They don't clear their phones. Yeah, in fact, the other day, they were like sitting in a restaurant and they were bored when my wife and I were doing something. They spent like a good half an hour just looking at old photos from years ago that were still on their phones and giggling and laughing and having a great time. And I've got to say, you know, like, my criticism used to be of photography. You take a ton of photos, you take them up, you get them processed, you get prints, and then you'd stick them in a shoebox and you never look at them again. So I guess, you know, this is sensible as putting things in a shoebox.
Yes, the only difference is 40 years from now, you can open up that shoebox and view your photos.
Do you really think that my teenage girls give a rat's ass about 40 years from now?
Like, I mean, they just, I totally agree with you. No, no, you only care about that 40 years from
40
now.
Years from now, yeah, exactly.
having gone through some moving of my parents and some family members lately, that's why that comes to my mind.
Yeah. Though I have to say, the other thing, interesting thing about this, is the nature of metadata. Because one of the things that I would love to have on the shoeboxes of old photos that we found when we were selling a house recently is any metadata on when they were taken and where. They're just like, you know, I'm sure they're relatives of mine. I just don't know who they are. Now, sometimes people write on the back of them, and that was a real discipline of logging stuff. But otherwise, yeah, you get photos. If they're not your photos, you're like, where was this? Who was this? You know, I mean, it would be great to somehow have the shoebox, metaphorically speaking, that also told you who was in the photo and where it was and what it was, which, you know, begs the question, is having your photos in some, you know, 500 Tumblr or something, is that something that I'll be able to come back to years from now and reference? I don't know. Probably not.
I don't know. Yeah. Interesting point.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to go do some work.
You bet. We have, really appreciate everyone taking the time to listen this week. A bit of a, not rat hole, but tangentially related, I think, this week. Don't you think? I'd love to talk. I'd love, one thing I want to do, a couple feed for questions or what our request for information about is, I'm curious what our dear listeners think about the Surface Pro 3. Someone also related, we were talking about in Adobe earlier, they showed some interesting touch UI stuff, which was kind of an interesting first glance and some stuff that I thought might really be useful, this tablet in kind of a semi-laptop form. I'm curious what the reality is of using Surface Pro, what the performance is, and so forth. I'd love to get some data points on that from our members, because I'm kind of pursuing looking into it a bit. I think they're doing some interesting stuff with it, but I'd be curious. Every demo that I see, or most of the demos, and even the nice videos that Microsoft does for it, it just looks a little slow and sluggish on the touch responsiveness. So I'm curious what the reality of that is, Surface Pro. So we can chat more about that next week.
Brilliant. All right. Good talking to you, John.
Good talking to you, and thanks everyone for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. This podcast is copyright FX PhD.